From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Federal Judge John Roberts rose to become Chief Justice of the U.S. in 2005, promising to be an umpire, calling balls and strikes. He has remained something of an enigma, intensely conservative, intensely protective of the court, intensely private. He has helped shape decisions favored by Republicans on abortion, on equal pay, on voting rights. In 2012, however, to the great dismay of many of his fellow Republicans, the Chief Justice upheld central elements of President Obama's signature accomplishment, the Affordable Care Act.
The statute here may be upheld as a tax increase on those without health insurance, which is within Congress's power to tax.
Leaving the question, just who is John Roberts? Today, his biographer will be my guest and answer that fundamental question. This hour on Point, the Chief Justice and his turbulent times. Join us. What does John Roberts stand for to you? What do you want to know about the Chief Justice? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me here in studio in New York City is Joan Biskupic. She's a legal analyst at CNN, a former editor-at-large for legal affairs at Reuters, and previously for many years the Supreme Court correspondent for The Washington Post and for USA Today. Her new book is called The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. This is her fourth, count them, fourth biography of a sitting Supreme Court justice. Joan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, David.
So as I said, you've done four of these. What made this different? Why did you want to do this one?
I got the idea of it as I was actually researching the others, because my earlier subjects all had intriguing demographic backgrounds, you know, the first Italian-American, the first woman, the first Latina. And they had come up with these intriguing personal stories. And here was Chief Justice John Roberts, who seemed to have no distinct background. And I wanted to probe that. I wanted to find out where he came from, who his people were, and how he maneuvered among the other justices, because his control was obvious, but the ways in which he controlled the court inside the court were not apparent. And when I started, David, I just want to add, it was late 2015, when I started in earnest, it was late 2015, Justice Antonin Scalia was still alive, and Justice Anthony Kennedy was in control. So much happened.
The key swing vote there.
So much happened in the time that I was researching this, and actually gave it even more relevance today.
Before we drill down on some of the central elements of John Roberts and the court that he now helps to oversee, sketch a picture for me. You're a lawyer, for the first time admitted to the Supreme Court bar. You get that little green light go up. You're standing in front of a lectern. You're looking at the court. He is right in the center. What are you seeing? Who is that in front of you?
When he is – which chair is he in this moment? Is he arguing before the court
John Roberts is the Chief Justice.
Oh,
you yourself are the lawyer for the first time arguing before the Supreme Court.
Okay. Because the only reason I ask is because in January of 1989, he stood in front of the Chief Justice for the first time when he argued.
It sounded like he was nervous and sick to his stomach at the time.
Exactly right, David. But now he sits there. So you're looking up, and I have actually on tours with, you know, casual behind the scene times been able to go stand over by it, but in an incredibly informal way. You're quite close to the tall mahogany bench. And the advocate who is standing there ready to present his or her case is looking right at the chief, who will say, "Mr. Folkenflik, you may begin." And there he is. And he, for the first part of the argument, usually, David, you should know, he almost operates more as traffic cop than questioner, because his associate justice colleagues all jump in very vigorously. And he has to try to stop people from interrupting each other. He wants to give the advocate at the lectern a little bit of time to finish. So immediately, once the Q&A begins, the lawyer is not looking at the chief most times. The lawyer is trying to figure out, who the heck just asked me that question? I hear something over from this side. Now I hear something over from this side. And it's quite a rattling experience, no matter who you are. And the first time, I understand, is just so nerve sweat inducing.
And so what are his questions like from the bench? Different justices have different demeanors. Justice Thomas famously almost never asked questions. Justice Sotomayor seems from your account to be very lively in how she presents things. What is he like when he asks questions?
A couple different motivations. Sometimes he just plainly wants to get information from the lawyer before him. Other times he wants to just plant the seeds of his own argument. A lot of people don't understand that. This is the first time the justices are together on any given case when they actually hear it. So they sometimes are arguing with each other and using the lawyer at the lectern as a bit of a foil. So he sometimes might want to communicate where he's at with it. He sometimes might want to get information. He sometimes might want to play devil's advocate. He's clearly very well prepared. He's read everything. He's come up with questions. He will often use colorful hypotheticals that get attention. He has a little bit of a whimsical way sometimes, but he's also very serious because he's trying to set a tone for the venue.
You know, we'll talk over the course of this hour a little bit about his background in Republican circles, legal circles, working at the White House, working with Ken Starr and others, although pre-impeachment inquiry. But I do want to get at the central tension that you – that sort of in many ways propels your book between the idea of being a true conservative and the idea of being a protector of the institution of the court as sort of above partisan taint. During his Senate confirmation in 2005, Roberts was at that time a federal judge already. He made the case he would not be an activist Supreme Court judge and that he would not be an ideologue. Instead, Roberts said he would strive to be a neutral arbiter, testifying that it was, quote, his job to call balls and strikes and not to pitch or bat.
Judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. The role of an umpire and a judge is critical. They make sure everybody plays by the rules, but it is a limited role. Nobody ever went to a ball game to see the umpire. Judges have to have the humility to recognize that they operate within a system of precedent shaped by other judges equally striving to live up to the judicial oath.
How well has John Roberts as Chief Justice in the intervening years lived up to that?
Well, it's mixed, and I don't know how much he, in his deep, deep heart, believes that that's what judging is all about. He knows that there's no sure strike zone in the Constitution. There's judging and judgments in what goes on when a jurist is trying to figure out the meaning of a statute or what the Constitution, which is actually a thin but deeply meaningful document, how it should be interpreted. That the slogan he had about umpires and balls and strikes, he had used it in his interview with President George W. Bush when he ended up being selected. And I think it's an ideal, and it's something that very much resonated with the president and resonated with the media and the public when he was before the court. But it's not that easy. It's not that easy at all. And I think his own record shows that he takes into account as Chief Justice other factors than just the black and white law before him. And often the law isn't black and white. And as chief, he also has the weight of the institution on him.
I want to take a call now from Appleton, Wisconsin. Steele, go ahead. Your thoughts on John Roberts?
Yes. I was listening on the radio to the confirmation hearings, and he made a comment that, you just said, he was the umpire, but he said it's the elected officials that make the laws, and the laws then the Supreme Court. And I just thought that was pretty interesting that, you know, it seems that all the politicians throw everything on the Supreme Court. So,
well, thanks for that, Steele. What do you make of that, Joan?
Well, that's a very intriguing comment and on point, but also but it also reveals some of the ambiguity that we have here. When federal lawmakers are writing legislation, they often – by virtue of the messy compromise process of legislating, leave lots of holes and leave ambiguity, and it falls to federal judges and then ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court to interpret what that means. And there have been so many times when this court has ruled in a way that members of Congress felt was contrary to what they were even trying to do. So there is a lot of play in the joints in terms of statutory interpretation. And then also, as I said, with the Constitution, all sorts of ways that federal judges look at the same provisions and differ. And just think of these nine justices on the Supreme Court now. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal, does not read the same text of the same words of the Constitution in the exact manner that Clarence Thomas might, or for
the
most part, yes,
and
for the most part, the chief too.
Want to briefly play something that gets to this tension. As a candidate and as president, Donald Trump repeatedly criticized the integrity of federal judges appointed by Democrats. Here's what he said last October, taking aim at a U.S. District judge who had blocked the administration from denying asylum to immigrants crossing the southern border without legal standing to do so.
This was an Obama judge. And I'll tell you what, it's not going to happen like this anymore. Everybody that wants to sue the United States, they file their case in almost. They file their case in the Ninth Circuit. And it means an automatic loss, no matter what you do, no matter how good your case is.
Justice Thomas Roberts said, you know, we don't have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges. He offered this rebuke, President Trump. He said, what we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best. In 30 seconds we have about left, couldn't you make the argument that President Trump in some ways is dropping the pretense in a kind of brusque fashion, doing us a bit of a favor?
Absolutely. I think what John Roberts wanted to say is that judges who are appointed by a particular president are not going to automatically rule for that president. But face it, anyone appointed by President Obama is going to be different from somebody appointed by President Trump. And John Roberts himself once had a hand in judge picking.
And we can come back to that in a moment. We're talking about the Supreme Court. It's Chief Justice John Roberts, the jurist and the person, with his biographer, Joan Biskupic. You can join the conversation. What questions do you have about how the Supreme Court operates under Roberts? What big decisions have caught your eye? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the third and perhaps least appreciated branch of the government, the judiciary. In particular, we're looking at its apex, the Supreme Court. You can join our conversation. How have your opinions about the court changed over the years, perhaps due to their opinions? What do you make of the partisan clashes over nominations? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me is Joan Biskupic. She's a legal analyst at CNN, longtime reporter on the Supreme Court, and author of a new book called The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. I want to talk a little bit about Roberts's own political belief system and his ideology. And I think one way to do that, one of the themes and threads it seems to me throughout your book, is the question of race. It's not clear, and we can talk about this in a minute, it's not clear to me why it works out this way. He's not very expressive about how he arrives at this, but it seems as though he's a consistent conservative. He says at one point, you know, the best way not to discriminate on the basis of race is to not discriminate on the basis of race, or something quite close to that. During his confirmation hearing in 2005, John Roberts was pressed over positions he had expressed while serving as a lawyer in Ronald Reagan's administration, in which at times he had seemingly recommended that the then Attorney General William French Smith take more conservative views on affirmative action and related race matters. Under questioning from the late Senator Ted Kennedy, the famous Democrat from Massachusetts, Roberts defended the memos that he had written expressly pushing back against the passage of the 1982 Voting Rights Act.
The articulation of views that you read from represented my effort to articulate the views of the administration and the position of the administration for whom I worked, for which I worked 23 years ago.
Then in 2013, John Roberts wrote a controversial majority opinion that struck down central elements of the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act that required federal oversight of local rules made by state and local governments with a history of racial discrimination in voting for African Americans. In her dissent, Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued that Roberts' decision significantly set back racial progress in America.
The great man who led the march from Selma to Montgomery and there called for the passage of the Voting Rights Act, foresaw progress, even in Alabama. The arc of the moral universe is long, he said, but it bends toward justice if there is a steadfast commitment to see the task through to completion. That commitment has been disturbed by today's decision.
That, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the notorious RBG, quoting MLK, the Reverend Martin Luther King. Joan Biskupic, could you tell me a little bit and explain John Roberts and race, where he comes from on this, and where he's evolved to, if at all?
This has been the most consistent area of the law for him. His comments that you just played, all of those just really encapsulate where we're at and where the court's at. Back in the Ronald Reagan days, he was following what his bosses wanted, but he subscribed to it. He believed that the Voting Rights Act had been too broadly interpreted, that it had to be cabined. And he had the idea, as you began to paraphrase, his exact line is, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. He actually believes that racial remedies such as campus affirmative action and certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act can be debilitating to racial minorities, and that they also go beyond the authority of what judges should do. That if such measures are going to be taken, they need to be crafted by elected officials. So he has long held these roots, and remember, even back in college, as I write in the book, he bristled at the liberalism that was still lingering in America.
At Harvard.
Yes, he had such great timing when he graduated and then had these two prestigious judicial clerkships and was ready to be launched in the world. Conservatism was starting to ascend in America with the election of Ronald Reagan, and he said he felt the call. And interestingly, in the Voting Rights Act ruling that you just read from 2013, his view is the broadly interpreted law is not needed anymore. He famously said things have changed in the South. The preclearance provision that you refer to that was in place to stop any kind of electoral changes before they took effect because they might discriminate, he believed that encroachment on local affairs was not needed. And Justice Ginsburg, who was very upset by his idea of what was happening in America and his rationale that it was no longer needed, and she said, throwing out this preclearance measure when it has worked and is continuing to stop discriminatory changes in election laws is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet.
It was a really evocative moment in the book when you quote her saying that. There was something that I thought was an interesting it speaks sort of adjacent to this, I guess. 2 years ago, John Roberts delivered the commencement address at his son's ninth grade graduation, and he stressed the need for hard lessons experienced through one's personal journey.
From time to time in the years to come, I hope you will be treated unfairly so that you will come to know the value of justice. I hope that you will suffer betrayal, because that will teach you the importance of loyalty. Sorry to say, but I hope you will be lonely from time to time so that you don't take friends for granted. I wish you bad luck again from time to time so that you will be conscious of the role of chance in life.
Joan Biskupic, what unfairness, what injustice, what bad luck has John Roberts experienced in his path to the Supreme Court?
That's an excellent question, and it is triggered by that wonderful commencement that he gave at his son's boarding school commencement. I would ask many of his friends, associates, family members exactly that question. What didn't work out for John Roberts? Can you think of a moment, a pivotal moment? And there were so few. You know, I talked to a lot of his pals from his own boarding school back in Northern Indiana. You know, what didn't go well for him? Was there anything he was bad at? And, you know, somebody would say, well, he wasn't that fast of a runner. You know, there were small things. And the one thing I would say, I know, it was he has had a very fortunate, good life. And that's a wonderful thing. That's good. And he is a very smart, determined, focused, hardworking individual. So he has taken advantage of the gifts that he has had.
It's interesting because the only thing left to hold on to is sort of political conviction and intellectual conclusion. You talk about race, and it's just a placeholder for a bunch of issues, but it's clearly one of the key ones on his mind. You know, he came, in your recounting, I think his father was a Bastille executive of some sort. He had a very good life. He lived in a privileged place in Indiana, went to a prestigious private school there, went to Harvard Law, was one of the top editors of the Harvard Law Review. This is not a bad thing. Like, this is good to him. And there's not a hint of anything, if we're talking about race, to suggest that harbors, at least in your account, any kind of bigotry of any sort. And racial, you know, the question of racial policies designed to redress past and potentially current injustice is a totally legitimate topic of discussion, debate, and disagreement. But it's interesting how central and how visceral it seems his reaction is to some of the proposals, some of the policies when he was a student, and some of the proposals in front of him and laws in front of him as a jurist.
That's right. And another speech that I like to point to, as well as the one that he gave at his son's commencement, was one that he gave at a commencement in 2013. Back at La Lumiere, which is the boarding school, the all-boy Catholic boarding school that he went to in Northern Indiana. And he talked about the value of persistence and saying persistence is the key to any success. He said you might have good looks, brains, great upbringing, good fortune, but what you really need is in life is persistence. And what I say is that's true, certainly. He was lucky enough to have had all those other things also. He had a lot going for him. But I think that someone like his colleague, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, might argue that persistence can't get everybody to the finish line and certainly can't get everybody to be first in their class as John Roberts was, is that other factors go into the mix. And that's why she has long argued that America has not changed sufficiently to drop attention to racial remedies.
And presumably some of the controversies and episodes we've seen in votes last year and in recent years, some of the laws enacted that have been challenged would seem to support the question of saying at minimum this is an open debate. We've got some great calls coming in here. I'd like to take some of them. Nate is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. What's your question for Joan Biskupic about Chief Justice John Roberts?
Hi, thank you for having me. I was going to bring up a coming decision that the court had almost not dealt with, and an ironic possibility relating to its outcome, talking about the method of rigging elections involving gerrymandering in the court case where basically a political party was allowed to not only put elections in its favor, but did a lot of sleazy activities in order to perpetuate that. And I'm talking about trying to hide evidence during the court cases. So you can see the depths that a political party would go to seize power. And now the court is looking at North Carolina and Maryland with perhaps the idea that, well, if you just do it with each political party having done this thing in one area or another, if you'll compromise so that both political parties can rig elections. And the idea that somehow it would make the court look bad to actually choose to involve go against the rigging of elections, I think it is kind of an irony. It's seen from the view of if the court involves itself in redistricting, isn't that stepping in? And the idea is, if you're the court involved in protecting people's rights, you should step in to protect your reputation as well as their rights. And if they try to avoid that,
Nate, I appreciate that point. Let me throw that to Joan so she can answer for it. And thanks so much for calling in. Joan Biskupic, where is John Roberts on that? He's got a case in front of him involving Republican gerrymandering. And in Maryland, he's got a case in front of him involving Democrats tilting the balance in their favor.
Well, let me say first that that caller from Wisconsin knows of what he speaks, because the case last year was from Wisconsin, where there was an extreme partisan gerrymander. And what John Roberts said in that case, decided last year, as a technical matter, the challengers did not have legal standing to bring the case. But at the core of his opinion was his resistance for the court and federal judges below to even be involved in resolving this. And what he said from the bench during those oral arguments, and he hinted at again this time around in the North Carolina and Maryland cases, was that he is afraid of how the public would perceive judges if they rule for, on the one hand, Republicans in one case, or on the other hand, the Democrats in one case. But as Justice Elena Kagan made the point last year in Wisconsin and again from the bench, what happens is the opposing party, no matter how many votes it gets in an election, is losing out because of how things have been rigged or devised. I mean, whatever verb you want to use on it, with the use of sophisticated computers these days and data analysis of how people have voted, people can the map makers can decide an election before a single ballot is cast.
I'd like to take another call now. Caleb is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Caleb, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, David. I just had a question for Joan. I really wanted to know, is there any way that Chief Justice Roberts could just be bipartisan? I have really noticed that in a lot of the cases where he has sided on either side, really it's the legal argument that I think is better than him deciding for one side or the other. Thanks so much for taking my call.
And thank you for that, Caleb. We also are getting some comments online about that question. He is sort of in the center of the court, but by your depiction and by certainly what we've read in recent years, that fulcrum has moved significantly to the right. Can he present a nonpartisan or can he help the court lift up above partisan politics? Obviously, the best example of that has to be the Obamacare decision.
Right, and he can. And I want to make clear to the caller from Atlanta and to all your listeners is that there are many factors going on here. And for him, in any given case, there may be no political external factors in his mind. It might be exactly how he wants to come down in a more moderate way, because he is chief, and he has said that he likely is voting differently because he is chief justice than if he was an associate justice because of the institutional concerns. And the cases that we've focused on so far, you know, the race ones and Obamacare in the background, those are ones that lots of cross currents were enveloping these cases. But in the run-of-the-mill case up there, he's going to try to go narrow. He's going to try to get as many justices on the case as possible. And even in the Obamacare case that we will talk about, you know, perhaps there was a part of him that thought, when all is said and done, that taxing power rationale, that holds up. That's it. So I am definitely not excluding that as one of the factors here. And I do think that for all the justices, some of the justices can evolve in different ways. And right now, John Roberts is at a pivotal point.
It seems to be a moment in some ways. We don't have a ton of time left before the end of this segment, but it seems like there's a ways in which the validity of that way of thinking about the court is in jeopardy. People are proposing things, ways of changing the court, because they're concerned about politicization. Some of the Democratic presidential candidates have expressed interest in exploring options to reform the court. Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is among the candidates who's put forth the idea of adding several more justices for a total of 15. He spoke with Fox News host Chris Wallace earlier this month.
What I think we need to do is some kind of structural reform that makes the court less political. We can't go on like this, where every time there's a vacancy, there's this apocalyptic ideological battle.
in just 20 seconds that we have, how viable is that politically? Could that happen?
I don't think it's going to happen. It's been 150 years since Congress set the number of justices at 9. It's not going to happen. But I think Chief Justice John Roberts had some of that in the back of his mind when he wanted to tamp down the politics of not just President Trump, but the public.
We're discussing the leadership and ideology of Supreme Court Justice John Roberts with his biographer, Joan Biskupic. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for her? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the Supreme Court and its influential Chief Justice, John Roberts. You can join the conversation. There have been a bunch of proposed reforms. What do you think about the court? Should it be updated for the modern era or left to operate as it has? Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me here in studio in New York City is Joan Biskupic. She's currently legal analyst at CNN, a longtime chronicler of the ups and downs and vagaries of the Supreme Court, and currently the author of a new book called The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts, her fourth biography of a Supreme Court justice. I want to talk for a moment a little bit about John Roberts' bearing and his health. You talk about how nervous he gets. You talk about how he kind of wanted to suppress how he felt at one point, and I think he ends up needing an appendectomy. You talk about the cold sweats. He seems like the most composed guy in public life, right? And yet, actually, it seems like there's a great degree of anxiety and introversion going on with him. And indeed, there's also this health issue that you don't really hear about. We know that Justice Sonia Sotomayor is, I believe, a type 1 diabetic. But you talk about these seizures that the Chief Justice suffered. And then you have this sort of little it's almost like a dependent clause in there. It says, just so you know, folks, when you have two of these, you're considered an epileptic. Is the Chief Justice an epileptic? Has this affected him in any significant way?
Well, let me separate the two, and let me take the easier part, the epilepsy, because I don't know a lot about that. I know plenty about the nerves and anxiety. He had two epileptic seizures that have become public. One was back in the early 90s when he was actually playing golf, and the other was in 2007 after he had become Chief Justice and he fell up at his vacation home. And I relied on information from the Supreme Court for both of those. And in terms of two epileptic seizures, meaning you could be vulnerable and have epilepsy, that just came from, medical information at the time. I asked people if he had had – people close to him, whether he had had any subsequent seizures, and was told no. But it's often very hard to get at the true health of a justice, but he looks good, he sounds good, and in that regard, whatever the true depth of his condition, it seems completely under control. And I want to make sure you know that I don't know a lot in that area.
Which is why you phrased it that way.
Yes,
you referred to a textbook definition,
yes,
but you said,
right,
I don't know.
Yes. I have no medical insight beyond what has been made public by the Supreme Court and other reporting at the time. The thing that surprised me that you picked up on initially, David, was, this nervousness. He had always had a bottle of Pepto-Bismol in hand when he was in college because he always had a nervous stomach. Whenever he had to give a public speech, he would get you know, many times he would get physically ill. And, you know, very close friends of his are revealing this to me. And then even into the 2000s, when he would stand up before the U.S. Supreme Court as an advocate and representing himself as, you know, he really was the gold standard in the eyes of many, including justices. But yet before he took the lectern, his hands would shake almost uncontrollably. And some of his lawyer colleagues who first told me about it said they couldn't believe it because they thought, this is John Roberts.
Not possible, right?
But I thought that a former colleague of his back in Harvard Law School, who was president of the Harvard Law Review, David Lebron, who's now president of Rice University down in Texas, had a line that I thought was so apt. He said, John Roberts is an introvert who has learned to present himself as an extrovert. And I do think there's some truth to that because he's obviously very reserved. I think he's shy in many ways, but here he has to participate out in this public forum. So I give him a lot of credit for overcoming what many people would say, well, I think I'll just spend my time in the library, do a lot of research, write some briefs, and call it a day. But he's put himself out there, and it seems to not come as naturally to him as it might to others.
Presents as an extrovert, but not the exuberance of a Sotomayor or the publicness of, say, a Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
That's right. Although Ruth Bader Ginsburg in person, it can be very shy herself, frankly. But on a personal level. But what he does is he's a fantastic speech giver. He has a wonderful sense of timing. He would practice, rehearse whenever he argued before the justices. And now when he gives a speech, he's got that thing down. He operates very well in structured settings. He's not naturally spontaneous, but he has an excellent sense of timing.
I'd like to take a call now from Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. Carrie's calling in. What questions do you have for Joan?
Hi, very interesting program.
Oh, great.
I have mixed feelings about Citizens United. I'd like to know maybe what his views were on that for the decision he made. In my own opinion, it seems like, now corporations are people too, and we're getting donations like crazy on the phone, and, you know, you can't do a survey anymore without having to give money at the end online, and it's I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's more a bad thing, but I'd like to know what his view was on it.
Joan, why don't you handle that for us?
Yes, he actually assigned the opinion. He was in the majority, ready to rule that the First Amendment of the Constitution requires the regulations that then at the time were on corporations and labor unions in terms of their contributions to political campaigns, that those should be struck down. And he assigned the opinion to Anthony Kennedy, who had long held the view that these restrictions were unconstitutional. He wrote a concurring opinion. We're back, just to bring everyone back to what the caller obviously knows about, the 2012 Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission ruling, 2010, I'm sorry, the 2010 Citizens United versus FEC ruling. And he not only, you know, was fully with the majority, assigned the opinion to Kennedy, but he wrote a concurring statement trying to reinforce the idea that this, again, wasn't a political decision, but this is what the First Amendment required. The court has long held that money is a form of speech, and John Roberts' idea is the more speech, the better, that both sides have an equal chance to make their case to the electorate.
Let's take a look now at sort of this counter-narrative for a moment. The question, the one thing that people sort of a lot of Democrats and liberals pointed to and said, oh my God, he could be the next hope. You know, he could, you know, and it led to him being attacked as something like a reproduction of David Souter, who was a disappointment to conservatives, nominated by George H.W. Bush and turning out to be moderate to liberal in his sensibilities. John Roberts voted to uphold what we call Obamacare and said that it was constitutional. But he took a shall we say, a meandering and winding path to get there. And in your book, what you reflect really fully for the first time is not only did he reverse where he came out, but the way in which he did it was sort of a surprise to everyone involved. What happened there?
Yes, he switched his votes on two different provisions. So not only did he switch on the individual mandate, which was the provision, is the provision that requires everyone required everyone to have health insurance. He also switched on the Medicaid expansion provision. When the justices
just take a second to explain what that is.
Yes. Okay. So Obamacare, you know, officially known as the Affordable Care Act, passed by Congress in 2010 after decades of failed attempts in Washington to control spiraling medical costs and provide Americans with higher quality health care, was, you know, a signature domestic achievement of Democratic President Barack Obama. It was challenged in two main ways. One is conservatives and some business groups said that the insurance mandate violated Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. And they also said that the expansion of Medicaid benefits, the law required the Medicaid program, which is federal money goes to the states to cover a range of needy individuals, that more people should be covered. More people near the poverty line should get Medicaid benefits. And when they, after three very closely watched days of oral arguments, the justices meet in their private conference room. No secretaries, clerks, anybody are – nobody's in there but the nine. At their first meeting, they vote 5-4 against that individual insurance mandate. That's what most people were looking at. And they vote also to uphold the Medicaid expansion, which had not been struck down by any of the lower courts. So that seemed predictable. But over the course of several weeks and months until we got to late June when the decision was announced, the chief switched his vote on both. He changed his grounding, his legal rationale. He never deviated from his point of view that the Affordable Care Act did violate Congress's interstate commerce power, but he decided that it could be upheld under Congress's power to tax. And what was interesting about that is that provision was never put to a vote in their conference, which is why so many of the conservative justices were so angry about that. But the other thing that I found out was not only that, you know, how the chief had gotten to the taxing ground rationale, but at the same time, he then changes his vote on the Medicaid expansion, wants that to fall, and two liberal justices who are working with him to try to uphold as much of the Affordable Care Act as possible, they switched their votes to then vote against Medicaid.
I mean, if this was happening in the Senate, you just call it horse trading.
Right.
Like, this is straight up like compromise negotiating. They're basically saying, look, we're liberals. We kind of want this Medicaid thing where the federal government would essentially assume almost all of the cost of expanding people being put on Medicaid, which would give additional millions of people health care above the poverty line. Just above the poverty line. But they're saying, look, we're going to go with you on that if that's going to go down so that you feel like you've got cover and you're going to stick with us on the main thing.
Justices Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan are pragmatists, and they wanted to make sure that as much of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was upheld as much as possible. And right into June, the pivotal month for the Supreme Court's decision, things were so much in flux. There were so many tensions. From talking to many justices, I found that – and I don't want to reveal how I got this story. So I'm talking about – you know, I've talked to a majority of the justices at the time in 2012 and then for this book through the years.
Someone in a trench coat in Arlington, Virginia in a parking lot late at night.
They said, follow the Medicaid. No. But they – you know, what I discovered is that these liberal justices weren't sure that they could count on the chief being with – the liberal side to the end to uphold the Affordable Care Act, and they
wrapped him in a warm embrace and we'll give you this.
Yes, and you know that was important.
That was the cause for a lot of consternation in conservative circles. Roberts had spent decades building an incredible record of sort of conservative and Republican I don't want to call it rigidity, but consistency, shall we say. There are a lot of key votes that he made. We referred to Shelby County versus Holder 2013, Voting Rights Act. A lot of listeners calling in and saying, you know, he gutted that. It's been hurtful for black and brown voters, particularly in the South. He was involved in the campaign finance, which we were asked about, which was sort of a largely a Republican position. He wrote a decision that overturned a preliminary injunction against the Trump travel ban, the ban on Muslims coming to this country from a number of nations. And it overturned – it also overturned the precedent of Korematsu versus the United States, one of the most shameful rulings in Supreme Court history from World War II against Japanese Americans for internment. But Roberts essentially allowed President Trump's travel ban to go into effect. And here was one of his most notable dissents. In 2015, the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in all 50 states. In a full-throated dissent, he asserted that the decision undermined America's democratic process. And then he kind of offers this lament, relegating a societal institution that had held people together from the beginning of human culture.
From the dawn of human history until a few years ago, for every people known to have populated this planet, marriage was defined as the union of a man and a woman. That is true for the Kalahari Bushmen and the Han Chinese, for the Carthaginians and the Aztecs, for any civilization at any time, at any place in the world, and certainly for those who wrote and ratified our Constitution. But today, five lawyers have ordered every state to change its definition of marriage to one that matches a new one that they favor, because those lawyers have, in their words, new insight and a better informed understanding of liberty. Just who do we think we are? I have no choice but to dissent.
And, you know, that was the first time in his career on the Supreme Court back in 2015, after basically a decade on the court, that Roberts read portions of a dissent that he had written from the bench. I want to offer the also for listeners and for you, the comments of a former constitutional law professor by the name of Barack Obama. He was a senator at the time from Illinois, a Democrat on 2005, to explain his reasoning why he had decided ultimately, although he had some respect for John Roberts, to vote against Roberts' confirmation in the Supreme Court.
He did say that he doesn't like bullies and has always viewed the law as a way of evening out the playing field between the strong and the weak. I was impressed with that statement because I view the law in much the same way. The problem I had is that when I examined Judge Roberts' record and history of public service, it's my personal estimation that he has far more often used his formidable skills on behalf of the strong in opposition to the weak.
Joan Biskupic, we only have about 30 seconds late. Justice left. Justice Roberts has new reinforcements with Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the bench. But was then Senator Obama right, or was that an unfair characterization of what we've seen in the years since?
I think it depends on which cases you're going to focus on. If you're going to focus on race, on religion, on same-sex marriage, he certainly seems to be in a camp that has a narrow view of what rights the people on the margins have in America. He wants those left to elected officials and not to judges.
You've been hearing there from the voice of Joan Biskupic. She's a CNN legal analyst. She's also author of The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. So appreciative you came in to talk with us today.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Sign up for our newsletter on the website. Have a good read there. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.